Another massacre in the U.S., 21 killed, including 19 children. This is the 8th mass shooting in the U.S. this year so far, and it's only the month of May. Why do mass shootings in the U.S. take place in the first place, more so than any other country in the world? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will take a look at why there is not a strong enough appetite or will from U.S. lawmakers, perhaps, either whether it's Republicans or Democrats, to put an end to this wave of violence, unless what's inscribed in the Second Amendment or the powerful NRA gun lobby are the main obstacles in reaching that. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us is David Swanson, is a director of World Beyond War, who joins us from Charlottesville.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. So I'm going to start with a question from you, Gerald Horn, and ask you for a reaction to what has happened, because it's obviously very depressing and very shocking that this has happened yet again in the U.S.
It's horrible, it's terrible, but it's also predictable. It's predictable because, number one, the United States operates under an archaic and antiquated constitution from the 18th century, during the era of the acceleration of the invasion of European settlers who thought that they needed weapons in order to massacre Native Americans to take their land and to import more enslaved Africans and needing weapons to keep them in line. And as you suggested, there's a Second Amendment that tends to validate that. But since then, you have this point that the right-wing movement in this country has latched onto that, because the right-wing movement in this country says that there should be no change in the antiquated interpretation of the Second Amendment because it might be necessary at some point in the 21st century, for example, for their movement to overthrow a government that they don't approve of. And then this industry, the arms industry, is a very profitable industry. It has been described as perpetrating an iron river of weapons into Mexico, which has really been very helpful to certain kinds of drug cartels, for example. They're meeting in Houston, Texas, as I speak, and there are about 55,000 members of the National Rifle Association, which is one of the most powerful grassroots organizations in this country. And then I think that we should not distinguish the point that this movement is based upon a white supremacy, based upon this idea that those defined as white have a virtual and veritable divine right to rule over everyone else in this country. And I would also say that when you have a foreign policy of the United States, which privileges this war, which routinely is involved in massacres of people in Afghanistan over the past two or three decades, or in Iraq in recent years, and other sites too numerous to mention, that it leads to the cheapening of life. And that cheapening of life has now returned with a vengeance back to the United States of America.
So what do you think, David Swanson? You have different dynamics involved here, of which, due to lack of time, I'd like to see how you can put this into perspective for us. On the one hand, you have the lawmakers, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. Seems like Democrats are more pro control of the situation in terms of gun control, for example, rather than Republicans. At the same time, you have what's been called the NRA, like Gerald Horn said there, they're a powerful lobby group. What does that exactly mean? Can you put these things that are pulling against what should be the prevention of the loss of life.
Well, I agree with every word that Professor Horn said there. There are structural problems and there are cultural problems. There are nations on this planet with similar cultures that have fixed the problem to an extraordinary extent structurally by banning guns. And the reason that this doesn't happen in Washington, D.C. is principally that they have legalized bribery and turned it into campaign contributions and made it perfectly acceptable so that politicians are openly bought and paid for. They also have this system of two parties in which, as on many issues, on this issue, one party, the Republicans, are openly and strongly against preventing gun proliferation, and the other party claims to be for doing something, but always manages to have a handful of its members against its supposed mission, even though it has the majority, and prioritizes keeping in place archaic rules like the filibuster that require it to have a supermajority that it doesn't have. And so it will use these tragedies as campaign material. Elect even more of us and we'll do even more than the nothing that we've done so far, rather than taking action to do something about it. And you do have a culture that's been saturated with acceptance of violence. You have the U.S. government through, in this case, the U.S. Navy, funding programs in schools like the one attended by the latest shooter to entice those who can't afford college, because college has outpriced many people in this country, to enter a program called ROTC, where they're trained to shoot guns. Very often, these shooters in high schools have been through these programs, have been trained by the U.S. government. In fact, the famous one in Florida was wearing the T-shirt from the junior ROTC when he shot up his classmates. And very disproportionately, mass shooters across the United States are veterans of the U.S. military, of U.S. wars. And so there is a culture of violence at home and abroad that creates these vicious cycles. It's a society saturated in both violence and guns. And unfortunately, we don't have a political system that seems capable of dealing with it unless we see a mass uprising of nonviolent action. And of course, the people of the United States are the least likely people in the world to do such a thing.
General Horn, when looking through and sifting through some of the points that could have been addressed in this program, one of the things that stood out is a tweet by this one particular person, which was pretty striking when I read it, and it said, in retrospect, Sandy Hook marked the end of the U.S. gun control debate. Once America decided killing children was bearable, it was over. Now, that itself is deep in the way that it impacted at least a point of view of such for me. But then when you take a look at what could be more, even more impactful would be when you have the use of guns and how it has killed politicians. Martin Luther King, for example, Kennedy, for example, and yet we're still looking at this being an issue in the U.S. So obviously there doesn't seem to be enough of an appetite, willpower, or initiative, or whatever you'd like to call it, for this to end. How can this be channeled in order to reach a solution?
Well, that is the question, is it not? But one has to say that when you have these formidable, profound issues in the United States of America, what has helped to change the calculus has been international pressure. That's the reason why slavery ended. That's the reason why U.S. apartheid, or Jim Crow as it has been called, began to retreat. That is why the United States was ultimately driven out of Vietnam in the 1970s, for example. And I dare say that because of the formidable nature of this so-called white American population, which unites across class lines, whether people want to acknowledge it or not, and is determined to hold on to power by any means necessary. Recall that it was only a few days ago that you had this racist massacre in Buffalo, New York, where 10 black people were killed at a store. The massacre perpetrator was motivated by this idea that the demographics of the United States are changing, that people not defined as white are becoming the majority, and he was determined to overturn that by his own crude action. And so we need more international pressure against the United States, not least because even those who consider themselves to be well-intentioned in the so-called white majority oftentimes have an inadequate analysis, which leads to inadequate prescriptions, which then leads us on this vicious cycle back to killing 10-year-old children in a classroom.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
NRA is going to be coming to Texas in a matter of days, from what we understand, David Swanson. You're going to have a number of politicians speaking there. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, we understand, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and Donald Trump. One thing he did when he was in office was, based on some of the things I'm reading here, reversing an Obama-era policy that had to that was dealing with restricting gun purchases by people, and deemed by the Social Security Administration to be mentally unable to manage their affairs. He reversed that. So that's just a reflection of how even former U.S. president looked at the matter. Why is there such a divide when it comes to U.S. politicians or lawmakers, I should say?
You know, when you started to mention a tweet, I thought you might be going toward a recent tweet prior to this latest massacre by the governor of Texas, pushing people in Texas to buy more guns because they were shamefully in second place behind California. There's a culture of love for guns. It's not a necessary evil. They're celebrated. The more guns, the better. And it's a cultural identity, a partisan political identity. In the hour before we were speaking, saw that same Texas governor have a press conference interrupted by the Democrat who had run for governor against him, demanding that something be done about guns. This a complete, almost worthless, sellout corporate moderate Democrat candidate, but even he willing to say something about guns, at least until he can get himself into office. You have a congressional race, a Democratic primary happening right now, the votes being counted in Texas, between a Democrat who's, you know, worthless on most issues but willing to take a stand on guns, and the incumbent Democrat who's absolutely against doing anything about guns, and you have the Democratic leadership in Washington, D.C. doing everything they can to keep that incumbent in office, even while claiming that they are the ones against guns. And so you have this endless hypocritical compromising from the Democrats, and this cultural celebration of guns as a wonderful, heroic thing. If you don't have weapons of war in your house, the government is going to come get you. You know, this government that can't tie its own shoes. And so there is a cultural divide, and there is, a political logjam.
Yeah, and some of the stats that I'm looking at, David Swanson, which points to the question that I want to ask you, I'm sorry, Gerald Horn, is the fact that, so you have these massacres, eight of them so far, by the way, and it's only May, as I mentioned in the intro. People are dying from gun violence on a daily basis in the U.S., daily basis. Now, this particular source talks about 45,000, maybe 45,800 injuries that include deaths. But it doesn't get into the complete number. It says 2020 is the furthest of this database that they have. But anyways, if it is such an issue, which it is, this gun culture and how guns lead to deaths and people are using it to kill each other. Why isn't it highlighted more throughout the media in the U.S. On a weekly basis? I don't know, on news channels, or more education perhaps on it in schools, et cetera. Is that happening and still not working?
It is happening to a degree. It needs to happen more, but I have to repeat what I said a moment or two ago. The ultimate problem is the fact that this gun culture comes from the bloody history of the United States of America, the history of a European invasion where the people who were not only rich, but the people who were poor and were settlers and defined as white were armed so that they could kill Native Americans. I'm sitting here in Texas. 200 years ago, this land was teeming with indigenous populations, particularly the Comanches. They've all been liquidated, exterminated. And so that helped to create this culture. And then, as I said before, you have to keep the black population in line, which is still happening to this very day. Many of our liberal friends buy into the mythology about the Constitution and the so-called sacred founding of the United States in 1776, which prevents them from dealing and grappling honestly with this bloody history. Instead, they blame political parties, which of course are ultimately dependent upon this same majority white electorate, which I've just excoriated. And so until we are able to deal honestly with this history, we will be continually
Let's go with that line that you're talking about. Dave Swanson, last question. God forbid that any type of social crisis, which the U.S. is teetering on, breaks out in terms of a civil unrest of a massive scale, large in numbers in the U.S., where you have guns almost outnumbering the people. Isn't the U.S. government worried about something like that happening? 30 seconds.
I don't think there's a grave danger of that happening. I do think there is a grave danger of these shootings continuing and multiplying and of the continuation of nothing being done in Washington, D.C. But in terms of a violent uprising in the United States, I don't think it's much more likely than a nonviolent one, which is what we actually need, but is extremely unlikely due to the disempowerment in people's own minds.
Thank you, David Swanson, director of the World Beyond War at Charlottesville. Darrell Horn, thank you, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston from Houston, Texas. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyarah of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements, we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام لما مر بهشام بن الحكم وهو يبيع السابرية في الظلال: يا هشام، إن البيع في الظل غش وإن الغش لا يحل.
Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam once passed by Hisham ibn al-Hakam selling fine cloth in the shade. So he said to him, O Hisham, verily the sale of goods in the shades is considered fraud, and verily fraud is not allowed.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we look at the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that the Imam talks to his companions about something called supplication, which is known in Arabic as ad-du'a. Now, du'a, of course, is this conversation that a human being has, this supplication that a human being has, this litany that a human being has with his creator, Allah the Almighty. Now, when it comes to dua, of course, there are many different ways to do dua. But what is interesting is that the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Holy Prophet, the divinely appointed Imams, even the Holy Quran, have taught us what to say in these duas. Of course, we can speak in our own language, we can talk about what we want, but of course, if you are talking to a supreme being or a higher being, there is usually certain formalities and certain protocols and a certain manner of speaking, right? You definitely do not speak to the principal of your school the same way that you talk to your classmates. Here, Imam al-Kadhim, while he speaks to his companion in this dialogue, he teaches them what to say, and he addresses Allah in the following manner by saying that, O Allah, you know the stealthy looks and that which the chest conceals. Therefore, withhold from me, O Allah, the hands of the oppressive ones from among the jinn and the men. Heal me and make me well, O most merciful of the merciful. And so here, dear friends, in this dua that was taught in this conversation and in this dialogue to his companion, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, teaches us that sometimes we have these stealthy looks. We look at one another while we are talking about a third individual, and without saying anything, we say so much with our eyes. Here, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says that Allah knows these stealthy looks that we have, and Allah knows that which we conceal within our chests. And there is another very interesting thing here which was brought up in this conversation and in this dialogue, and that is that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam requests the Almighty Allah that the hands of the oppressive ones from among the jinn and the men, may Allah protect him from these hands. And finally, we find that Imam al-Kadhim in this dialogue speaks about healing, and he requests the Almighty Allah to heal him and to heal all of us, really, and to make us feel well and whole, for Allah is the most merciful of the merciful. So, dear friends, we must be careful upon how we look and how we look towards others, what we say to others, what we hide within our chest. And of course, may Allah protect every single one of us from the oppressive ones and the tyrants from among the jinn and the men. And ultimately, may Allah heal every single one of us, for He is the most merciful of the merciful. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movements of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. The condition of the Shia movement, which was a movement led by the imams, a movement in the political sense, is an activity, an organized activity against the authority, to overthrow an authority, a regime, and to establish a new government. That is, of course, the ultimate example and the most drastic example of change that a movement would be moving towards. But a movement can only be a movement if it's about change. If it's about keeping status quo, then it wouldn't be a movement. Movement only makes sense when you're moving away from status quo. Of course, there are many movements that identify as movements, and the only difference is the people who rule. In other words, there have been movements to overthrow regimes, overthrow governments, overthrow kings, overthrow dynasties, and the objective of that has been some form of change, but that change is not the change in status quo in terms of the ideology, in terms of oppression, in terms of anything meaningful to the masses, to the people. The only thing that is different is that the movement is about overthrowing that particular dynasty, that particular individual, to put in power someone else. The movement of the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in, was not that. The movement of the Shia has not been that. The movement of the revolution, which is the continuation of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt, is not about removing the Shah from Iran and establishing rule for another person. It's about changing status quo from it being a rule that is based on whims and desires, whoever that may be, to the rule of God's law and the rule of God. That is the change that is intended.
For listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdusalam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose the specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hodeidah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. The situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is freezed and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their apartment 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theater. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, symbolic statues like this, that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen, how people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war, they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Chernomil of Donetsk.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer, this despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy.
Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area.
Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factories safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but eight Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe, and maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground, and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theater at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theater the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theater. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There's a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone, has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, the Sunday Times Rich List.
In this country, it says, 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working, and obviously we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that the majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out suddenly. Out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentments at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Pourriz up, London.
The Limelight.
In Britain, details have emerged of what appears to be another alcohol-fueled social event inside No. 10 Downing Street during lockdown, one that was seemingly not investigated by the Metropolitan Police or the official civil service investigation. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Peter Walker. The piece is titled, "The Bar is Open. Details Emerge of New Downing Street Lockdown Event." In Britain, new details have emerged of what appears to be another alcohol-fueled social event inside No. 10 Downing Street during lockdown, one that was seemingly not investigated by the Metropolitan Police or the official civil service investigation. According to the British newspaper The Mirror, between 30 and 40 staff drank alcohol and ate takeaway snacks to mark the final press briefing conducted by Boris Johnson's then spokesperson, James Slack, on 17th of November 2020. A photograph obtained by the Mirror appears to show an official setting out bottles of wine and drinks. The picture was reportedly sent to No. 10 Downing Street staff on a WhatsApp group in response to a message saying, "Time to open the COVID-secure bar." The photograph was then posted as a reply with the message, "The bar is open." Other messages reported by the Mirror seemingly demonstrate premeditation in socializing, with one referring to Wine Time Tuesday and others discussing going to buy reinforcement booze. One official said, "If someone can help me carry, I'm happy to go." The alleged event was 4 days after the leaving drinks for Lee Kane, Boris Johnson's head of communications. On Monday, ITV News obtained images showing the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, at the event, raising a glass and seeming to toast Lee Kane and make a speech. Those images have placed pressure on the Metropolitan Police to explain why Prime Minister Boris Johnson was not fined for attending the 13th of November gathering, when others at the gathering were fined. The 17th of November event was not among gatherings investigated by the Metropolitan Police and was not listed among those examined in the interim report into lockdown breaching parties by the senior Cabinet Office civil servant Sue Gray. Sue Gray's full report is expected to emerge this week. James Slack, who was a civil servant rather than a political appointee like Lee Kane, was chosen to replace Kane as head of communications. The 17th of November drinks were held to mark the last time that, as Boris Johnson's official spokesperson, he spoke to the media at the daily lobby briefings, according to reports. At that time, because of the lockdown, the briefings were being held virtually rather than in person. James Slack left No. 10 Downing Street in April of 2021. That leaving party held in the day before Prince Philip's funeral, while indoor social mixing was still barred, was reported and investigated. He is now the deputy editor of The Sun newspaper. Evidence of what appears to be yet another social event, and one planned in advance, puts further pressure on Boris Johnson ahead of Sue Gray's findings, amid reports more Conservative MPs could be submitting letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister. If Sue Gray's full report is released this week, it would most likely be submitted to No. 10 Downing Street in the morning and published shortly afterwards, with Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising to give a statement to Parliament and answer questions from MPs later that day. No. 10 Downing Street has said that Boris Johnson would then aim to hold a press conference. A No. 10 spokesperson said, as part of their investigation, the Cabinet Office team were able to speak to No. 10 staff to establish the facts on what happened during this period. Both they and the Metropolitan Police have had access to all information relevant to their investigations, including photographs. The Metropolitan Police have concluded their investigation, and Sue Gray will publish her report shortly, at which point the Prime Minister will address the Parliament in full. Boris Johnson's former spokesperson, James Slack, was contacted for comment.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the privilege and honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so very much for being with us, sharing your time with us.
The pleasure is mine.
Thank you. We have so many cool topics to discuss.